Welcome to the Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays read by Leighton Pugh.
Chapter 27. Market Complexity and Remaking the Moral Case for Capitalism. Ian Martin. Those of us above a certain age will all know what a financial crash is supposed to look like, in television and media terms, in the electronic era of rapid mass communication. There's a horrible beauty to it. The red line heading down on a large graph on the screen showing a sharp fall in share prices. In the crashes, or brief market reverses as they turned out to be, of the late 1980s and 1990s, footage of the red line filmed at the height of the emergency tended to be intercut with footage of men, traders, shouting and gesticulating dramatically. The signal was obvious. Look, even the well-paid people who are supposed to know about this stuff, the business of managing money, are in a state of blind panic. Something terrible is happening here, it said. Something important, usually the entire stock market, has markedly less value than it did yesterday or 5 minutes ago, and no good will come of it for the rest of us. Financial firms and stock exchanges soon came to realize such footage broadcast in an emergency only makes matters worse by increasing the herd-like sense of panic. Now, any television crews admitted onto trading floors are shown rows of earnest types tapping into keyboards, trying to look like the calm and reassuring data scientists they are. In 2008, the public relations people, for the most part, managed to keep the televised media outside looking in from where it filmed stunned bank staff leaving their offices carrying cardboard boxes. But the red line, down, 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 was ubiquitous on television screens during that crisis. It was just such a red line that brought home to me the enormity of what was happening on that morning in October 2008, when the Royal Bank of Scotland, briefly, at the wrong moment, the biggest bank in the world, crashed. I had, for 3 years, been the editor of the Scotsman newspaper in Edinburgh, hometown of RBS, at the height of the boom, and had admired the bank's success, with some reservations, without really understanding how it had managed to get so big so quickly. And there it was a few years later on the television screen, its share price collapsing, down 25% in a matter of minutes, with confidence in the institution's ability to fund itself evaporated. By that day in 2008, I was working as a department head in the newsroom of one of the UK's main newspapers. We stood and gawped at the screens turning red, and then snapped into journalistic mode, asking questions. Once you asked 10 questions, another 10 occurred. It was dizzying. Modern markets had developed to a point of complexity beyond popular comprehension. Before the 2008 immolation, I thought I had a good grasp of how the world worked, as a journalist and writer on politics with an interest in economics. I didn't. And it was my ignorance during that crisis a decade ago that first prompted me to start writing books about financial history. There was worse to come, once I set out trying to understand by asking questions and telling the story. I soon had a horrifying realization. Many of those in charge of the system did not understand it either. I did, though, have enough of an understanding of politics, as a political journalist by trade, to grasp, along with many others, that this confusing crisis was going to have a long tail, that is to say a profound and enduring impact beyond finance. And what an impact it has had. This was an epic crisis of such violence that a decade later it continues to shape our politics and arguments about ethics and public policy. Among the wealthy and comfortable, those who benefited disproportionately from the asset price bubbles inflated as a consequence of the measures such as quantitative easing, QE, introduced to prevent the crisis turning into a depression, it can be tempting to think that with the banks rescued, 2008 was a blip, a bump on the road in the successful story of financial globalization. But that is a delusion, I'm afraid, at odds with the evidence of what continues to flow. Populism on the left and the right has ballooned in recent years. The migration crisis may be the greater driver of discontent in countries such as Sweden or in Germany, the EU's powerhouse state, but the elites blamed for not taking concerns about migration and culture sufficiently seriously are, in the popular imagination, the same elites who defend or enable the global financial system. Dig down, and you find that money and finance, unfairly distributed, is always in there somewhere as a source of resentment among angry voters. In the UK, it has been much more direct. The financial crisis and the rescue drove increases in public debt. Then the policies implemented by the Conservatives to slow and check that rate of growth in debt triggered arguments about austerity and inequality. It revived the far left. A decade on, the decision to bail out the bankers and to not put any of their leaders in jail is still cited by British voters and politicians, such as former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who was in charge of policy in the UK until 2010, as an explanation for deep discontent. The ideas of Karl Marx, tested to destruction, it had been thought, are back in vogue, and the leader of the opposition Labour Party is surrounded by genuine Marxists. Several of Jeremy Corbyn's advisers were, until recently, active communists. This is not overblown rhetoric, merely an acknowledgement of the facts, and worth stating because it is so shocking considering the previous assumption that the fall of communism at the end of the Cold War was supposed to have finished that creed off forever. Yet the old far left is back in Britain, with new support from younger campaigners, members, and a slice of the electorate. In America, the experience has been different, although the term socialism is being used approvingly by a new generation of activists there too. The post-crisis backlash took the US rightwards, not to the left. Barack Obama was elected in the midst of the crisis, but the slowness of the recovery on Obama's watch was one of the factors that explains the appeal of Donald Trump in the 2016 US general election in states that the Democrats had assumed were Hillary Clinton's by right. Trump spoke to those voters angry with elites, including financial elites, that intersected with mainstream party elites. This was classic American populism. What of the EU and the Eurozone? During the initial stages of the crisis, with Wall Street and the City of London in meltdown, there was some smugness in Northern European chancelleries that this was an Anglo-Saxon crisis arising from greed and gambling, to which sensible mainland continental Europe was immune. This turned out to be nonsense. German banks had filled their balance sheets full of rubbish too. The Eurozone crisis that followed showed that the Eurozone debt machine was a flawed construction. Resentment with the elites who designed the euro, another troubled globalized financial project, has contributed to the current situation in Italy. At the time of writing, a weird left-right populist coalition governs in Italy. If that is the right word, considering the eccentric antics of its main players. In Spain, a left-wing populist government spent the late summer of 2018 attempting to arrange for the body of General Franco to be exhumed. It is difficult to think of a proposed act more likely to galvanize conservative opinion in that country by reopening the wounds of the Civil War period. There has been another change since 2008 to 2009. Almost everywhere in the West, the difficult argument over globalization, is it beneficial, is it fair, what are its proper limits, was largely restricted, pre-crisis, to activists, anarchists, and mask-wearing demonstrators on the agitprop far left who marched at international summits. No longer. In the last 10 years, concern about globalization has gone mainstream in the form of anger about the scale of migration flows, with the question of economic migration and refugee status becoming entangled. The rules of the international system were designed before an era of mass air travel and instant digital communication, and they are going to have to be redrawn to fit new realities. The financial crisis might not on its own explain these shifts in politics, but in the West it made the weather. As a historical period, the climactic end of the West's long boom and controversial aftermath may even end up ranking alongside the impact of the defining year 1973 with the oil crisis and the end of the Bretton Woods financial system and other related emergencies. That ushered in a new approach to economics on the centre-right that became popular, although hardly universally so. The broad consensus among policymakers about open markets lasted from the mid-1970s until 2008. As an advocate of markets, what worries me most about the current situation is that a decade has passed and before long there will be another correction or downturn as part of the normal and natural process that occurs in developed economies. American monetary policy is finally normalizing after the shock therapy of the post-crisis period. The US economy is strong and, at the time of writing, growing fast, boosted by tax cuts and deregulation. But when the next recession does eventually occur, politics in the West is dangerously primed. The populists are well positioned. Markets and capitalism, along with migrants, will get the blame. Some of the populist parties already in place are theoretically pro-market, but that will not matter in the scapegoating process if it comes. If you do not like these principles, we have others, as the old saying goes. European populist parties can and do adapt at speed in an economic emergency, as they demonstrated in the Italy of the 1920s and Germany in the early years of the 1930s. In the UK, it is obvious already. The newly resurgent far left under Corbyn talks in terms of wanting to put people before profit. That sounds beguiling, people before profit. Apart from the obvious point that you cannot do much for people unless you make a profit. Rather than just sitting waiting, I wonder if it might be possible to construct a new political economy and a defence of the market economy in an era of resurgent protectionism and populism. There is, however, a major complication, and that is the reality that market complexity, thanks to technology, has increased in the last decade and is only going to keep on increasing. Finance is transferring to the cloud away from the mainframe computer. Transactions are becoming more difficult to see inside. Speed and volume get ever greater. In that respect, one of the main difficulties for those who believe that profit is the essential product of a healthy, functioning commercial society is that what was once easy to explain has become increasingly hard to understand or conceive. The merchant or free trader of the late 18th and 19th centuries in Britain or France or Germany had no difficulty understanding markets and the elementary aspects of a market society and the principles underpinning it. Of course, there were financial instruments that only a banker in Hamburg or a market maker in Paris or London understood, but the basics of the system, use of resources, deployment of capital, debt, insurance, invention and innovation, were relatively easy to follow for the engaged and literate citizen. In London, the traders may not themselves have read Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, but those who ran the ministries or published newspapers had. Later, the Marxists, having studied Smith, had an alternative, simple, if wrong, explanation for what was going on. But classical liberals had their own accessible language for explaining why free trade and markets worked. It was a relatively fair fight. Today, financial capitalism has grown so complex, with systems so intertwined and autonomous, and technology growing ever more powerful and fast, that it is extremely difficult, even for its advocates, to understand. What do I mean by market complexity? We hear a lot about artificial intelligence and the dilemmas this will pose as it pushes new boundaries. The vision presented is frequently dystopian, of humans monitored and scanned, powerless against a giant, autonomous, whirring machine. The writer on technology, Andrew Keen, has spoken about the need for consumers to take back control. He's right, and he is hardly alone. But the area, outside warfare, where technology has had the biggest transformational impact in the last half century, is in financial markets, the debt machine, the wiring of the global economy, without which sophisticated trade is impossible. Computerized trading only began in the US in the period between 1975 and 1977, with a series of regulatory reforms and the establishment of computerized transactions. In the UK, it was slower, and the switch to computers in the stock exchange only took place in 1986, with the Big Bang regulatory revolution launched by Margaret Thatcher's pro-market government. This helped make London once again the main European financial centre. Incidentally, that event, the Big Bang, is often presented as an example of deregulation. Wrong. It was the introduction of regulation, the application of law, in a field, stock markets, which had previously been managed informally by the market participants themselves, according to the rules of a club with codes of behaviour governing proceedings. That revolution in the 1980s in London was initially about equities, but of much greater importance is the global debt market. Global long-term bond issuance in 2016 was $21.4 trillion. Of the $300 trillion global market, only about a quarter is comprised of the stock market. Selling, insuring, and swapping that debt is the main business of the markets. Globalization meant a mammoth scaling up for financial firms through consolidation and the race to expand, creating in the process banks that are so large that it would be beyond the ability of even the brightest CEO to understand all or even half of what their institutions do. We saw this play out in the financial crisis, with CEOs introduced too late to the complex instruments their staff had been selling. But if markets are only to become more complex, and the systems more autonomous still, in the era of fintech, how on earth can we manage and cope with this process, so that the advantages are retained, profit, the juice that funds investment and incentivizes innovation? The Chinese answer to these complex problems is mass control and the single party. Fused with a revolution in the payment system, it may become the dominant ideology. For free societies interested in human dignity and free expression, that is unappealing. Is there a democratically sustainable alternative? If there is, the answer in the West lies not, I suspect, in the contents of Smith's Wealth of Nations and a crude interpretation of that work, or in just banging the drum for profit. Smith's other great work comes into play instead. The theory of moral sentiments reveals Smith as a much more complete and rounded thinker. Enlightened self-interest is at the core of it, but obligation to others and the public realm matter just as much. Going in that direction does not mean so much radically reforming capitalism as reinfusing it with that spirit of obligation. Tech reformers and radicals speak of this purely in terms of the need for regulation, but there is an entirely false choice there. The idea that there are only two alternatives, laissez-faire or the regulatory state is wrong. Of course, there must be regulation. Markets outside the Wild West have always been regulated, even if only by law and civic code. Only the most devoted libertarian thinks there is no role at all for regulation. Smith was clear that the public realm and markets are not in conflict. It is not one or the other. They need each other. One pays for the other. But markets only function truly effectively within a sound legal framework. This was understood by Teddy Roosevelt in the US at the start of the 20th century, when, as a trust buster and reformer, he tackled vested interests in the pursuit of the public interest. Soon we will need some of that animating Rooseveltian spirit if we are to create a new political economy in the West, a new language of politics and markets when complex finance and rampant tech emerging. The largest tech companies own the cloud, on which the banks are building their platforms and into which the banks are pouring their and our data. Add technologies such as blockchain, which creates an unbreakable, impenetrable, and secure record of transactions, and potential successors to blockchain, and you have financial behemoths which will become increasingly difficult to see inside. I finished my book, published in 2013, on the collapse of RBS, by asking speculatively of banks and technology companies whether we work for these new giants, these money machines, or do they work for us? Technological change continues year on year to make the question more pressing. It is a new democratic emergency revolving around an old question. Who is in charge? We had better be sure it is us, as voters and consumers, through our legislatures, but it will be impossible, outside of an authoritarian regime such as China, to micromanage these corporate machines or to have oversight of every single aspect of an institution's activities as the technology outruns regulators. We can make directors of these new generation companies even more directly accountable under the law, with much tougher sentences and sanctions to encourage them to be alert, behave responsibly, and minimize any damage. But our defense will have to rest first and foremost on an appeal to ethics, obligation, and duty.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.